The Guardian.
Welcome to Film Weekly at the 68th Venice Film Festival. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, myself and Zan Brooks are wandering along the Lido on the Venice Lagoon, searching for cinematic gems from around the world. We'll be running through the first films to dip their toes in the waterways of the festival, featuring George Clooney, Madonna and Roman Polanski. But we've not forgotten, there are some choice releases back in the UK this week too, not least the latest outing by British director Ben Wheatley. I'll be meeting Ben and leading actor Neil Maskell to discuss the chillingly strange genre film Kill List. Yes, it's the high watermark of film podcasts. It's Film Weekly.
I just spoke to Ida Horowitz.
Yeah.
She's threatening to release the story.
How did she find out?
Don't play dumb, Tom.
You think I leaked it to her?
Yeah, who else?
Yeah, I didn't leak it to her, Steve.
Well, I know I didn't, so that leaves you.
Okay, well, what does she know?
She knows whatever you told her.
Did you tell anyone?
No, did you?
No.
Did you admit to meeting with me?
No.
All right. Then we stonewall her, and she's got nothing.
She's going to take the story to Drudge, or to Roll Call.
She's trying to blackmail me. She wants info about Thompson.
Well, then tell her what she wants to know.
That's Man of the Moment Ryan Gosling as a political fixer and Paul Giamatti as his political opposite in a scene from George Clooney's Ides of March, which opened this year's Venice Film Festival. Talking of chicanery and spin, joining me here in the Club Orizzonte Terrace outside the casino on the Lido is Film Weekly cohort Guardian critic Zan Brooks. Ciao, bello.
Ciao to you, Jason. It's lovely to see you here again.
We are in the sun. It has just rained, in case people think that we're just kind of swanning about. It has been a downpour. The weather's quite good this year. Sometimes it's not. What about the sort of turmoil surrounding the festival? You know, it's half built. They're kind of finding places to put this festival now.
It's half built, and it's surrounded by a city that was built a long time ago and is now kind of crumbling into the lagoon. And with all the sort of swinging government cuts, the sort of maintenance grant for the city has been slashed. So we're really living in the ruins here.
But in a way, like customers at Pizza Express, we're helping with our tourist tax, which started about 2 days before the festival, and now it's been extra levied. I mean, I presume the Guardian's paying yours and mine. But, you know, like the Venice in Peril Fund, we are helping that out. I feel good, in a way.
Is that the sole reason we're here, do you think?
I think so.
Sort of like benign philanthropists.
Yeah, exactly. We're saving Giottos and Tintorettos as we speak. Let's look at the first few films. A packed couple of days that have started the festival, seeing films from Madonna with WE, or perhaps that's We, which will come to that, Roman Polanski with Carnage, and that Clooney movie. So we'll start with The Ides of March, why not, which you're a little wary of.
A little wary, only in that I wanted it to be great. I think I'm a sucker for the political thriller, and particularly political thrillers that have the texture of proper backroom politics and what goes on and the grubby business. You know, they say that the two things that you should never actually see behind the scenes are sausages being made and political bills being drawn up. And this is written by Bo Willimon, who worked on the Howard Dean campaign back in 2004, and he does bring a kind of insider's eye to how it all works, how a campaign is run, the loyalties, the betrayals, the etiquette that you don't know when you're from the outside, but when you're inside you have to know it because it's life and death.
It's a sort of mid-level political story as well. I mean, I kept thinking, looking at it at Ryan Gosling's Spin Doctor, who sort of began working his way up, Mike Morris, played by George Clooney, up the ladder towards him, that we weren't quite dealing with the kind of most important people on the ladder. We were kind of dealing with some sort of mid-level politics. For me, that kind of lost some interest, or for you not.
No, not necessarily. I mean, I guess it's the Goodfellas line as opposed to the Godfather, isn't it? You've got, you know, Don Corleone at the top, but then you've got the foot soldiers that the Goodfellas looks at, and this looks at the foot soldiers of the political process. That's no bad thing at all. I felt that this was a film in two halves, and both halves have a kind of merit to them. The first half is very much insider tour of this world, and then about midway through it flips into being quite a conventional political thriller, which is good in a way because you're then sort of gripped and you want to know how it ends and the excitement starts building, but it's much more conventional and a little bit cynical, and for me I think less satisfying in the end.
Yeah, I actually was sort of started out a little less interested and became more interested. The other half satisfied me. I thought it was a good festival opener. It's nice to have Clooney here. And I thought Ryan Gosling was jolly good, as he always is, actually.
He's great, isn't he? I mean, and he's the real man of the moment. But, you know, you've also got Paul Giamatti, who is the curdled old warhorse who's working on a rival campaign. And there's this great line where Gosling says, "Politics is my life," and Giamatti just kind of cackles at him because he is the future yet to come.
It's kind of a bleak look at politics. I mean, it wasn't particularly about a president or politics in general. Doesn't really, even though George is clearly a big political animal and his films are about men sitting down discussing weighty issues from Goodnight and Good Luck and Syriana to this. It sort of politics doesn't come out of it very well. It doesn't look like politics can solve much, according to George.
Well, I guess it's the old adage that politics is showbiz for ugly people, isn't it? And obviously George isn't the ugly person here, but there's the sense that these people are compromised and that George Clooney is this sort of centre-left poster boy. His ideals are good, but he's got skeletons in the closet. He's maybe not the great man that we hope and pray that he is.
I was pleased to see Philip Seymour Hoffman in there, a good time, Max Minghella in there. It was a good kind of cast. Where do you think this film's going to go from here? I think people are sort of, I was looking at the betting from Paddy Power, which for some reason puts Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method at a 5-1 favourite for the Golden Lion. But it's got Clooney's film, The Ides of March, a 6-1 on for an Oscar nomination. Do you think it can go that far?
I can't see it, really. And, you know, who knows? You die a death trying to second-guess Academy voters. I don't think it's quite got the heft and the depth that people look for in Oscar nominations. I mean, there's a film still to come at this festival, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, that the buzz around that, and from all that I've heard about that, that seems more Oscar calibre.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can only wait and see how the Ides of March goes on. I think I liked it a little bit more than you. But then we had Roman Polanski here with Carnage. Well, not Roman Polanski himself. I don't think he's allowed into Italy. I don't think he's allowed into New York either. So strange that his film, Carnage, begins with a long locked-off shot of the Brooklyn Bridge and New York from over there. I think he sent the first AD over there.
I think he did, yeah. I was watching that first scene thinking, this isn't him at all. it's interesting, isn't it? This is all set in a Brooklyn apartment that was recreated by the great set designer Dean Tavoulouris in a soundstage in Paris. And it's a film that never leaves the confines of that apartment, apart from very briefly at the beginning and the end. And, you know, hell is other people. And Polanski has made a career out of making films in which hell is other people. And he's an absolute past master at this kind of claustrophobic chamber piece. His direction is very unfussy, it's unhurried, and it's utterly precise. And it's a film, it's a comedy, I guess. It's a black comedy of social mores, but it's absolutely agonising. And I kept... The characters, you've got the four characters in a room and they keep trying to leave and they keep getting to the lift and then being called back and you're just thinking, please just get out, it's not going well, leave. And I kind of wanted to leave myself.
Yeah, I was feeling nauseous because Kate Winslet characters start feeling really nauseous in I suppose, an unforgettable bath scene. Bath, B-A-R-F. I was like, oh God, it's funny. I get that when I do go to the theatre. For me, this was like going to the theatre, which isn't necessarily a good thing. As you know, I hate it, but I sort of hate it because of the bourgeois kind of enclave that it is. And not only was that kind of mirrored by in the audience who were all guffawing away, but also by the people I'm watching, because it really was about kind of the middle classes in whichever country. This happens to be Brooklyn, but you know, it obviously worked for the Italians from Rome and sophisticates from London. And when it was originally set in Paris.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, the great thing about the theatre, if there is a great thing about theatre, is that there's always the element that you are a protagonist in the drama, in that if you cough, they will hear you. And I felt the same way watching this film. It's superbly acted in a way that very much calls attention to the fact that it's being acted. It's very actorly, a little bit over the top, but it is superbly acted by... great cast, John C. Reilly, Jodie Foster, Kate Winslet, and Christoph Waltz, who obviously won the Oscar for Inglourious Basterds, and he has a sort of pretty passable American accent. And I kind of saw him as all of these people are awful, all of these people are dreadful in their own particular way. I almost saw the Christoph Waltz character as the sort of Polanski substitute, in that he's this sort of cold-blooded, slightly misogynist guy who gets all the best lines and sort of stands aloof on the sidelines a lot.
There's a lot of him fiddling. First, he fiddles with a cake. He eats a cake, which he does in Inglourious Basterds. He drinks coffee, which he does in Inglourious Basterds, and he's drinking whiskey. I kept thinking it was Hans Lander come for tea. Can you imagine the kind of awfulness of that? I have to say that I was you know, very impressed with this film. And I kept thinking of Rosemary's Baby. I kept thinking of Catherine Deneuve running around that flat in London in 1967. So, you know, there was a lot of Polanski in there. And I always thought of The Ghost as well, his recent one. So there was a sort of clamminess to this, and this very much claustrophobic. And I really felt terrible during this film.
I wonder if actually getting arrested and holed up in Zurich was the best thing that happened to him, because he's having this weird late bloom as a filmmaker. And you were mentioning the barfing scene earlier on. Kate Winslet got like the biggest round of applause I've heard in Venice for throwing up on a coffee table. And you think, maybe this is what people wanted Kate Winslet to do all this time.
Yeah,
she's been getting it wrong, getting undressed and getting a kit off. What they want to see is her do a kind of absolute kind of emetic kind of situation. There was a bit, I was having a bet with a girl next to me as to how long it would be before Kate Winslet did take her kit off. And there's a little bit where she kind of unbuttons her blouse, but she doesn't go all the way.
She doesn't. And that's with Polanski. I mean, if you're not going to go all the way for Polanski, then who are you?
I was a bit wary of the cast. I thought, what are Jodie Foster and Kate Winslet together? But I thought they were both very different and both very good.
It's a terrific film. I mean, you know, again, we're getting back to kind of possible Oscar nominations. I'm sure at least one of those four will pick up something.
Yeah. Interesting enough, did you see who played the kid in that shot in New York, one of the kids? I mean, we couldn't really see their faces, but you see who it was?
Yeah, we're talking about Polanski's surrogates in this film. The actor who plays the aggressive kid who commits the crime is actually Elvis Polanski.
Yeah, that's a good name, isn't it, to conjure with? I mean, that's not enough that you've got Polanski as a surname. Give him Elvis. Nothing to live up to there, Elvis. Go ahead. Yeah, the film is about the fallout from an argument over one kid hits another with a stick, and then it's a middle-class argument as to guilt and all of that. We should have perhaps added that at the start, but it doesn't really matter. We're talking about a film that none of you have seen yet, because that's why we're here at Venice at the premiere of Carnage. Another film that nobody had seen until we came here to the Lido was Madonna's film W.E. We have just seen it. We're literally fresh from seeing Madonna's film, Zan. And to use like a term of a Madonna fan, oh my God, what was that?
There's something beguilingly awful about bad films, isn't there? That you watch, you know, I watched the Polanski film desperate to sort of run away, but in a good way. And I watched this for the same, in the same way, but in a very much bad way.
Okay, we're dealing with two split stories. One, a story of Wally, played by Abbie Cornish. She's obsessed with Wallace Simpson. She keeps going to Sotheby's to an exhibition of Wallace Simpson's jewels and drawing room. And then we flash back to the 1930s when King Edward is abdicating the throne for the love of Wallace Simpson, played by Andrea Riseborough. But what's Madonna doing here? Is she melding two different periods? Does it work?
Well, Wally is named after Wallace Simpson and is obsessed by Wallace Simpson to a degree that I think would set psychiatrists' alarm bells ringing, and yet Madonna presents it as evidence of her impeccable good taste. I think that we're supposed to see these two women as sort of spiritual cousins separated by a generation or two, in that they both love looking at jewellery. They both love kind of big country homes and tapestries and things like that. And I guess they both want love, the love of a good man, whoever that man, whether it's the king or the security guard at Sotheby's.
Because Abbie Cornish is Wally. I kept thinking Wally was going to come in, you know, go and watch kind of Hello Dolly and kind of start clearing up. He was the proper Wally. She's got a terrible husband who's a doctor, and then she has an affair with the security guard. At Sotheby's for sort of no real reason. That modern layer of the story, I had no interest in it whatsoever.
Not at all. I mean, they did a similar thing with Possession, didn't they? And it didn't work with that, the film version of that. This was a disaster from start to finish. And yes, obviously the modern aspect of the story is fatally mishandled and bungled, and poor Abbie Cornish kind of staggers through the action like a sort of doped pony, like not quite knowing where she's going. But the rest of it is awful. We're supposed to find Edward VIII attractive, but he's sort of this kind of mincing, peevish little git. There's obviously the elephant in the living room at all times is the fraternising with Nazis and going off for holidays with Hitler and things like that, which Madonna keeps kind of glossing over. And occasionally we know that Wally's husband is a wrong'un because he says, oh, they were Nazi sympathisers. And she says, no, they were naive, but that doesn't make them Nazis. And there's a lot of kind of apologies thrown in to deflect from the main charge that these aren't nice people.
It's fascinating that Wallis Simpson, who played by Andrea Risborough, is clearly sort of the lead in a way, but she's clearly a substitute for Madonna. She's interested in crucifixes that are bejeweled. She's interested in wealth. She's interested in seduction. She's interested in selfish behaviour that brings down a nation in some kind of way, and slightly feels sorry for it afterwards. I just felt she was obsessed with her own obsessions in this film, and it was a very cold bit of filmmaking. I actually thought it started out not so terrible in the way that Swept Away, when Madonna first comes in as an actress, you think, I can't watch this, I can't listen to it. It wasn't so bad, but by the end I was just saying, stop, please stop, really.
Yeah, it's a shocker. And you're talking about how we're supposed to see Wallis Simpson, and there's a key scene, and it's Madonna's big kind of directorial flourish in this film, and there's a lot of pointless directorial flourishes throughout, but the big one is Wallis stepping up on stage with a Maasai tribesman and dancing to the Sex Pistols' Pretty Vacant. And I guess Sofia Coppola tries that kind of anachronistic soundtrack and gets away with it a bit. But here you're thinking, why? What are you saying here? Are you saying Wallis Simpson is the first sort of punk rocker who kind of brought down a nation? This grasping, venal, little social-climbing madam is somehow, you know, representing the spirit of revolution.
And I think she sort of admires her for being a grasping, venal social madam. She's just like, oh, yeah, I was one of those too. The film world, it seemed to be sort of embracing Madonna. I know Venice is just happy to have Madonna here, or M, as they call her, like some kind of like James Bond boss. That's what Andrea Risborough calls M. I don't know which she says call me. I'm going to call her M. Is that all right?
Yeah.
M seems to have sort of graced that. You know, I think it's a terribly difficult place to kind of premiere a movie, but people clapped. No one booed.
And apparently, you know, my colleague Mark Brown has just come out of the press conference and was saying that the questions are very respectful, and yeah. You know, the sense is that if not a masterpiece, it's a perfectly respectable piece of work. And yet, it's not. It's a calamity. I mean, Madonna made her first film a couple of years ago with Filth and Wisdom that I actually didn't see.
Nearly the Die in Berlin.
But apparently, that was a complete disaster. I can't believe it's worse than this.
Oh, I think this looks pretty, at least, but pretty vacant. And then there are some scenes you're just going, what are you doing? She's obviously discovered tracking shots. Someone explained to her that this was a dolly track, and she goes, can we use that? So it just goes up and down and up and down the corridor.
And when Edward says that he'll abdicate the throne, as they're having this crucial conversation that will have far-reaching consequences, he's pursuing Wallis around and around a tree in, I think, Balmoral, after which Madonna obviously has got a crane, and thinks, I wonder what a crane can do with a camera on it. And so cranes up the trunk into the treetop. And you think, but why, apart from the fact that it's a tree and she can?
Terrence Malick did it. Perhaps she saw that and thought, oh, that's brilliant. That means some shit. Madonna, like a virgin touch for the very first time at this film festival. I don't know. Zan, I've sort of been intrigued by the first couple of days at Venice. I think it's shaping up to be a kind of a classic edition of the festival. You mentioned Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is forthcoming and which we'll wax about next week. I'm very excited about that. But what are you thinking? That there is much to come?
There's masses to come, and on paper it looks very good. We've got A Dangerous Method, David Cronenberg's film about Freud and Jung. We've got Alps by the Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos, who's very good. We've got Steven Soderbergh's Contagion, which doesn't look so good, but who knows? And obviously British hopes resting on Shame by the British artist Steve McQueen, and Andrew Arnold's retelling of Wuthering Heights.
Zan, you'll be back next week with me to take us through all the stuff that we haven't yet seen and some more. Mille grazie to you. Thank you very much to see you. Lovely to see you. To read Zan and for the best Venice Film Festival coverage on the web, just go to guardian.co.uk/film. Kicking off the Venice Days sidebar here was Chinese director Lu Ye, a regular in competition at Cannes, but instead bringing to the Lido a Paris-set, sexually charged romance between Taha Rahim's scaffolder Mathieu and Corinne Yam's refined student Hua. It's enticingly called Love and Bruises, and certainly isn't afraid to show all of those. Lu Ye is a director I've long admired for films including Suzhou River, Summer Palace, Spring Fever and Purple Butterfly. His work has famously brought him into conflict with the Chinese authorities, and his film's selection for high-profile international festivals without the government's and censors' approval has seen him banned from filmmaking on mainland China for 5 years. So I was delighted to finally meet this, in my opinion, superb filmmaker. And I began by asking Lu Ye how he, a non-French speaker, found working in cinema's home, Paris.
First time I went to Paris was 10 years ago for my film Suzhou River. I really like Paris, and all my previous films have the post-production finishing made in Paris. So Summer Palace, Spring Fever, Purple Butterfly. So I went there quite often. And then I found the novel by Liu Jie, and I was very, very happy that it was set in Paris, so I had the chance to adapt it.
And I love the story.
Yeah. Ah, you speak English, you see, but not French. Is it difficult to work in a language that you... Because this is the very, very French performance, Taha Rahim and Corinne Yam. Okay, I know she speaks Chinese as an actress, but, you know, these were very... It was a very Parisian story about, you know, the different types of people who live in Paris. Did you have to understand the city well?
Well, I work with two astonishing translators on the set, so it was quite easy to switch from the French to the Chinese, so it was not really a problem.
What about the language of cinema? The French have so, you know, been influential in the language of cinema, and watching your film and people in the streets of Paris, your handheld, your kind of verite style... I was thinking of French cinema. Is that something that influenced you as a filmmaker when you were studying film, when you were growing up? Yeah. I was thinking of Jean-Luc Godard did La Chinoise, a film. I don't know if this was a film. I think most Chinese filmmakers that I speak to are aware of this film. Are you?
Yeah, the Godard is a great director. So it's my teacher, actually, when I as a student in the university. And I loved Godard's film because he's very strong and very touch, very deep touch the ordinary life. So it's not only about the move camera or jump cut. It's not only about this. It's about the true life. So this is very important for this project.
Louis is surprising us both with his fantastic English. Poor Eddie, the translator there, who's doing such a good job, is suddenly like, oh, now, what do I do?
I'm useless. I'm useless, totally.
I need a translator. So actually, the Hua is the main actress in the story. The character is a translator.
He's the lead character, Hua, is a translator. Yes. That's her job. Looking at the film, it occurred to me the film is about being in between places, being neither here nor there, being in love one place and having your life somewhere else. This must be very personal to you, as you are you have travelled around and been made to travel, and your films have been banned and you have been banned. It's a story of exile in some kind of way.
Yeah, it's between the different country and a different way, but actually for every people is like this, because human and human is different. So if you try to touch another people, so you can sometimes you are in the middle. Mm-hmm.
So you can go back to Chinese if there's difficult ones, if it's easier for you in Chinese.
Sorry.
No, don't worry. Your English is astonishing. I'm surprised. That's the most surprising interview I've ever done.
I don't know.
There's a lot of sex in this film. It's a little bit of sex and bruises as well, and that was also very important in your work. Very intimate sex scenes in this. How did you work with Taha Rahim and Corinne Yam to film these sex scenes? It requires a good freedom from the actors.
I think the novel is more sex than the movie. So I'm a little bit less the sex. But actually, this story is a start to sex. It's and ending in sex. Mm. So this is a very physical feeling. So it means maybe is the physical feeling is very important. Maybe it's a very simple thinking. It's very important for the people. Mm. So Mathieu is a very, very easy, very simple thinking.
And Huawei is more intellectual and thinks as sex.
So it's a good, but it's a problem sometimes.
The I wonder, your sex is often in your films. How is that received in China now? Are they more used to you? Do they expect this from Lu Ye now?
I'm a sex director in China, so maybe it's too much, but I think it's a very easy way and a very important way to the love story, to the love life. So because you must face to sex, and then you can think about love.
Are you banned in China still? What's the situation there?
I think it's the ban is finished next Monday, I think. Yeah, 5 years and next Monday.
Are you sure?
I'm free.
Free to do what?
Free to I can make a film in China, mainland China. So this is good news for me and also very bad news for me because I need give the script to the censorship office again after the 5 years. So I don't know how can I do. I don't know the future, but I try.
So you're there the first Monday morning, the ban ends, you're there at the office saying, right, I want to make a film again.
Yes, for sure. I need the work again in China. Mm-hmm. So a lot of audience waiting for me, for us. I will try.
But do you have to now be good? You have to make a film that they like, because that's why you got banned, because you do films they don't like.
So I don't know the future. I just try.
Yeah, well, I wish you luck with that. Meantime, I'm very pleased that you worked in Paris, because we got to see, and all this time when you were banned, you made three films actually, which I'm just really pleased to see.
Yeah, this is not against, I think. It means if you you are a director, if you try to make a film, no any people can stop it.
I think they should be very proud of you in China and the films that you make. So I think being in festivals like Venice and Cannes is good for the reputation.
I don't know.
For yours, if not theirs. Lu Ye, thank you very much. Xie xie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I can do that too. And Eddie, you started off great.
Well, yeah. Someone stole my job today.
There you go. You meet Lu Ye. He speaks great English.
Well, it's better than mine.
Thank you very much. Thank you for Love and Bruises. Less all this sun and Prosecco go to my head, I think of you back in Blighty or wherever you are and your weekly needs. There's good stuff on at your local in the unlikely shape of Kill List. This violent, funny, plain weird movie is about two former soldiers back from Iraq, now employed by a shady group to bump various people off, the Kill List of the title. It's a job which has sinister consequences on their personal lives.
Knock, knock. Where? Local, UK.
How many on the list?
Three, not two strangers. How much?
Don't ask. Shell got you.
It's nice. You ain't got Fiona.
Is this when you met your sisters?
Nah, boxer size. Hey, man, tell ya. A lot of fit women. Release the sexual tension as well. I can knock it till you tried, you.
She likes your rafting.
Wouldn't you like to fuck her now?
Yeah, I'm too old for that shit, so are you.
Yeah, speak for yourself, Grandad.
Kiev was...
Yeah, I know. Listen, man, it was 8 months ago. Gotta get back on the horse again.
I went to meet director Ben Wheatley, whose first film was the equally unusual gangster-come-soap opera Down Terrace, along with his lead actor, Neil Maskell. Ben Wheatley, Neil Maskell, the director and star of Kill List. Congratulations on Kill List. I saw it. You know this, Ben. But I saw it the other day and I was like, what am I watching? This is weird. This is really weird. And it kept creeping up on me. The further I got into the film, the further I was being plunged into weirdness. And I felt like the carpet was being swept under my feet until the end. And I still don't really know what I've seen, but I almost can't stop seeing it in my head. Thanks for that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Is that the idea?
Well, absolutely, yeah, yeah. I wanted to make something that was properly horrible. You know, if you're going to do a horror film, you've got to, I think you've done the audience a disservice if they don't feel slightly like they've been put through the ringer, you know.
I mean, there's sort of everything in there as well. I mean, you say it's a horror film. I'm not even sure that it is, you know, in classic classification. I mean, Neil, you were obviously working with Ben quite closely on getting that element. Did he always pitch it to you as a horror film?
Yeah, when we spoke early on about it, it was he spoke about it in those terms. But obviously, the acting of it, it wasn't so much kind of running down corridors being chased by the scary monster. It was like playing a drama out, you know. So it was probably a different acting experience than most actors have working on a so-called horror movie.
What was the process like? Because it feels quite improvised. I mean, Ben's last film, Down Terrace, also had that feel to it. What was he like working with him camera wise? And is it different to? I mean, you've done a lot of UK independent films, Neil. So where does this one stand? It seemed to me that the end product was something rather different to usual.
I suppose the key difference is that the way that Ben works is that you do a take that's the script, the scene as written, then you do a take that's improvised, and because, you know, it's digital film now, you don't have, the film doesn't run out, so sometimes you can shoot an improvisation that lasts 12, 15, 20 minutes. Then you go back onto the script, and then often you do like a paraphrase or a more concise version where he says, okay, now do the script, but it's in as few words as you can, so half-finished sentences and stuff. And what starts to happen is that the improvisations, even though what might get used in the film is the scripted dialogue, the improvisations will inform that. You've lived through that, so it gives the actual text a history, you know, because a history that you've just given it 5 minutes before,
right.
and because obviously as well, Ben's sort of done everything over the years, been an editor, been a director, you know, shot all sorts. He knows that he can cut round that stuff and just lift, you know, what works out of the improvisations. But as I say, it is mainly the text. It's just you don't normally work in that way.
Yeah. It sounds to me that there's a sort of Mike Lee would like to work like that, and everyone who works for Mike Lee, who has to sign up for 6 months of doing that sort of thing, would like to get it done because you do it in 6 days.
Yeah, well, I talked to Neil about sending him to Afghanistan to be a sniper, and weirdly he wasn't that excited about it. So I thought we'd just go the normal route, you know.
Try acting, boy.
Yeah, you read some Andy McNab books, didn't you? That was the research, and then away we went, you know.
Yeah. I mean, would you like to work like that? I mean, is it because of your budget? Do you know what I mean? If you were established and could put people through that kind of method, would you do it? Or are you happy with that you've got a kind of shorthand to get to where you want as a director, to get your cast doing what you want them to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think I couldn't possibly say about how Mike Lee works. I don't know. I mean, I think it feels to me that's more... No, I'm not even going to say. But it's more theatre. It feels like it's come from a theatre background where it's a lot more rehearsal stuff, and I've just never worked like that. I really enjoy the way that we work, and in a way it's more, as we go forward and do longer, more higher budget movies, it's just trying to retain that way of working rather than throwing it away and going, oh, we've got more time, that means we don't have to work at such a blistering pace as we do. I think that working fast and thinking fast is really good, but maybe it just means we can just shoot more and more and more stuff. I don't know.
You've got quite used to working that way, Neil, whether that's out of necessity or that's just because you spent a long time in low-budget British films, good ones as well, that I like very much, but there's a certain sort of them. Have they all been like that, or is that something that you've always wanted to do as an actor? That's the way you work, you know what I mean? It's on your spotlight page, does, you know, blue eyes, accents, and works quickly.
Yeah, the difference is, I think, that mostly what gets thrown out when you're doing low budget British film is the time that you have to get the acting right necessarily, so you have to walk on and deliver, and the time is taken up sort of the same time as you'd have on a big budget film is taken up lighting the scene and making sure that the focus puller's happy, you know, that, and then we get one take and we're moving on. You know, the sort of joy of working on this was that you didn't feel like your time to get the scene right was lost. You know, Ben generally tries to light the scene 360 degrees. Laurie Rose is an amazing DP, is operating and focused, pulling at the same time, and, you know, just trying to catch what he can. There are no marks on the floor, so the acting is the priority, which was the great pleasure of.
It's really nice. I've seen you around Soho for many years, and in bits and pieces, not off screen and on screen. To get to see you have a lead, Neil, I was relieved. I thought you were fantastic in it, magnificent even.
Well, it's very kind. Thank you very much. Yeah, no, I've been knocking around the industry since I was very small. So yeah, it was very, and a great honour to be offered a lead. You know.
And did you know when you got the script such as it was, you went, oh, the lead, right? Because I'm used to kind of turning about, getting to page 4, seeing where my character is and probably dying by page 28.
Well, it didn't evolve in that way, really. We keep sort of telling this story about that I was working with Ben in Bucharest on an internet viral. We'd worked together briefly before.
People work on those, do they? I thought they just sort of happened.
Well, yeah.
It takes a lot of planning to make them look like they just happened.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And we were in, like, a jacuzzi, actually, one morning before work, and he said he sort of was talking about another film that he had an idea of, like, a comic version of Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, yeah, set in the Philippines. And called Get Jakarta, I said that it sounds brilliant, you know, and I loved that film. We started talking about Warren Oates and all this stuff, and he said, well, I'm glad you said that, because I've pitched it with you in the lead. So that was more when my surprise came. So by the time that had then sort of metamorphosized into a short that he was doing, and then that became Kill List, you know, he was the fact that he'd stuck by me, and he still wanted me in the lead role was, as I say, it was just this great honour, innit?
He had seen you in a jacuzzi, Neil, and you've seen him, so you know where you've got to stick together. You know where the bodies are buried under those bubbles.
I was in the jacuzzi before he turned up, so I didn't have that kind of moment of him seeing me drop into it, which would maybe he wouldn't have not respected me as much as he does today. But a lot of it had come from, because I worked with Neil on Wrong Door, and which is a BBC Three like sketch show, and it had a massive cast. It was, I think, it was about 60 cast members in it. So I met tons and tons and tons of people. I met Mianna there as well, and Mianna Buring, who's in Kill List, and Michael Smiley as well. So. And basically, I just, you know, made a mental note of who the people I'd worked with on that show, and go, oh God, I'd really want to work with them again. I really want to work with them again. And it's just slowly, you know, moving forward. So we did Down Terrace, but I don't think I've been in contact with you. It took me a while to get the contact details off the casting lot.
IMDb Pro, you sign up now.
Yeah, I know, but it's like £12. I'm not paying that. It's too much money, that, really, isn't it? Just to get a photo up.
Yeah. No, I'll cast my neighbour instead.
So, yeah, you know, and kind of... I think it's really important, you know, it's that mixture of, like... I've met Neil a couple of times, but I really liked him, and I thought, I know I could get on with him, and I know he's really good at it. And then beyond that, I don't think you need to cast around for, you know, go through loads of different people. So yeah, it wasn't a massive streak.
Yeah, and especially as we're sort of talking about a genre film, but I think it's a film that mixes all the genres, the Kill List. And I don't want to give anything away to anyone. So I'm not talking about your movie. I know we've got the director of acting here. We should kind of talk about the meat of the movie. But I think it's sort of movie that is better as a surprise to people. I just sort of saying to people, go and see it, because in a way I sort of don't really know what you've got there, and I mean that as a sort of high compliment. Do you know what you've got? Is that what you wanted?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's the thing about cinema. It's like, it depends where you go, doesn't it? If you're going to watch stuff you've seen, kind of remembered from before, and you it's like comfort food, and it's like that film I watched when I was a kid, and I want to watch it again and again and again, the same movie with the same characters doing the same thing, you always know what's happening in it, then that maybe Kill List isn't for you. But if you want, like, an intelligent horror movie, which is also... will scare the living daylights out of you and make you feel really, really uneasy, and which I think is what horror films are all about, then this is a film for you. It's kind of like, you know, it's going back, looking back to the 70s when, you know, cinema gave you a bit of respect and kind of thought that you were an intelligent viewer rather than just a numpty.
Where did you come from, Ben? I know you mentioned that you've done some BBC Three sketch shows, you've done Modern Tasks as well. Quite a lot of the comedy scene is where you came from. Well, if you're watching Kill List, you're probably not. You wouldn't imagine this is a man who only falls on horses in his blood.
I never worked on fools. I don't know. I think comedy and horror are pretty close in their DNA. You know, it's like it's one of the few types of cinema where you get an instant reaction and you can tell whether it's worked or not. Like that, you know. So and it's about, you know, set up and payoff. So that side of it. Having said that, I think Kill List is pretty funny, you know.
Yeah.
But obviously it's not a comedy, so that would be wrong to pretend that it was.
Well, that's like Scorsese, it's funny how, funny like I amuse you, funny like I'm a clown, and that's, to me, Kill List is very funny as well, but you're right, I didn't tick the comedy, but that was the idea, presumably, with the actors, to get that banter going between you and, you and Mianna and you and Michael, I suppose.
Yeah, I knew Smiley, I suppose, slightly similarly as you've known me over the years, kind of socially. We've come across each other a few times, had lots of mutual friends. How Ben knew that there'd be that chemistry or that banter, I don't know. It's kind of testament to his ability as a director to put people together. Yeah. good fortune. very quickly we... We all sort of bonded and managed to find that interplay between, and it's there between us personally. I mean, me and Smiley, you know, see a lot of each other and are very good close friends now, but we weren't when we went into it. And again, a lot of the improvisation, the comical improvisation fed the comedy that was already in the script. You know, it's hard not to laugh. I don't know how well you know Michael, but you know, when he speaks, it's funny.
It's one of his skills as a comedian, isn't it? Yeah.
Talking.
But I know lots of comedians who are not, you know, who are really miserable sods. But, you know, Michael's just constant, isn't he? You can't turn him off. Yeah. He's just got that fast wit. And I found him very entertaining. And I think that's in the film. My enjoyment of sharing his company is there. You know.
And a bit of a wrestle as well. Nice to see you grappling. I wanted naked fight, but... You know, I'll do clothes. You don't want to be putting people off their dinner. The Kill List is quite scary enough. I'm going to have to wrap it up there now. Could talk to you for hours about
on that image.
Yeah,
exactly. Of me and smiling naked.
See, look, you two in a jacuzzi. I'm done for the day now. Ben Wheatley, Neil Maskell, brilliant. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And Ben Wheatley's Kill List, starring Neil Maskell and Mianna Buring, goes on UK-wide release from Friday, the 2nd of September. The Venice Film Festival is still in full swing, so next week we'll be bringing you a comprehensive roundup and more interviews from the festival. I'll probably call it a Film Weekly Venice Festival Special. The music featured on this week's podcast is by the great Italian composer Ennio Morricone. His rousing theme, incidentally, for Battle of Algiers, actually intros every film in the Venice Days section here this year. But we've been using his equally memorable score to Terence Malick's Days of Heaven. Reissued this week in the UK in a sumptuous restoration. Not your average Richard Gere movie, but certainly one of the most beautiful films ever, ever made, with Nestor Almendros' photography and this Morricone music. Wonderful stuff. Before I drift Malick-like into reverie and cue shots of stagnant waters and Venetian flora, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer back in London, Jason Phipps, it's arrivederci tutti, until next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.